We're going to be looking this morning at 1 Samuel 20. And then the next 2 weeks, we're going to be doing something a little different. I asked Pastor Dean if he would do a lesson on the subject of exhortation, and he's going to do that next Sunday. And then the Sunday after that, we're going to have a visitor teach us, a man who you've met probably, who has been here in the past, and his name is Burkholder, Steve Burkholder, and he's going to be teaching us on evangelism, but not in any kind of a theoretical sense, just in the sense of how you do it, and some sharing some of his own experiences in the process of doing evangelism. So we have that to look forward to, those two Sundays to look forward to, and I think it'll be a blessing for you. I hope that you'll be sure and be part of it. The subject that we come to in chapter 20 of 1 Samuel is friendship, where we see the friendship of David and Jonathan. And it friendship is something that we all have some feel for what it means. Scripture says if a person Proverbs says that if a person would want to have friends, he needs to be friendly. Well, that's good. And I think we are a friendly church. But being friendly is different from friendship. Friendship is a step up from being friendly. And I think there are probably a lot of people in the world who would have to say they actually have no friends. Sadly, but truthfully, that they just really do not have anybody with whom they would consider themselves a true friend. People with whom they're friendly, people with whom they have an acquaintance, but not friendship. And I think that may be the result of their incompetence as far as how to develop friendship. They just don't understand the principles. It may be that they don't want friends, ultimately, that they think they want friends, but they really are not ready to make the sacrifice to have a true friendship. It may be that it's just the age we're in. I think older people can use the you know, pretty soon we're going to meet out there, you guys, because there's more and more of you piling up in out there. I think the computer helps people who know how to make friends do it, but unfortunately today, I think the computer has become a way of relating to people in which friendship is no longer, it's really kind of stripped down and meaningless. It's not, there's no real interaction. There's no face-to-face interaction. There's no real honesty and certainly no intimacy in the friendship. Friendship is one of God's most wonderful gifts to mankind. Friends are neighbors who help one another. They are dependable companions. They are people who are willing to make sacrifices on one another's behalf. They're people who become dear to other people and allow other people to become dear to them. Turn over to 1 Thessalonians 2:8, where we see the words of a man who understands friendship, that man being Paul. And he understands there's an investment involved in real, true friendship. There may be sacrifices that have to be made if there's going to be true friendship. There's certainly a turning loose of one's control of one's own emotions, in a sense, if there's going to be friendship. There is a reduction of the protectionism that keeps us from getting too deeply involved with other people so that they might impose on us. And in protecting ourselves from that, we strip ourselves of the opportunity for true friendship. But in 1 Thessalonians 2:8, Paul says this, to the Thessalonians, having thus a fond affection for you, we were well pleased to impart to you not only the gospel of God, but also our own lives, because you had become very dear to us. Friendship is an investment. It's going to cost you something. It may cost you time. It may cost you the comfort of simply holding back in privacy and protecting yourself. It's going to cost something. But if you don't make that sacrifice, you're going to go through life without any friends. And it's sad to see that happen. In 1 Samuel 19, David is going to has already formed a friendship with Jonathan. But in the dynamics of that friendship in this chapter, we learn some principles about friendship. Just to give us a running start in this chapter, in chapter 19, the chapter before this, David's had to flee for his life from Saul. He's found refuge with Samuel at Naioth, and Saul has come after David there, but God has intervened to protect David. And as we saw last time, the thing that's driving this need for David to continually escape from Saul, and will drive it throughout the rest of the book of 1 Samuel, almost up to the end. Within the last two chapters, Saul's going to die. Did I say running from Samuel? He's not running from Samuel, he's running from Saul, obviously. So at this point, David is running for his life. Having escaped by the power of God from Goliath, having overcome Goliath, David's now having to escape from the man for whom he fought against Goliath, and that was Saul. David at this point starts thinking differently, and it's not a good change. When he was facing Goliath, he's just trusting the Lord to help him deal with someone who's there's no chance this guy is going to relate to him in any way other than that of a mortal enemy. It's not like he's got a friendship or a relationship with this guy at all. He has nothing. He just doesn't want to get killed by this guy. And in a sense, it's easier to deal with people on that level than it is as a friend, where they can reach into your heart and take something from you that can be extremely painful. And so David starts thinking differently. He's not thinking, I can trust the Lord to get me through this. He starts thinking self-protectively. He doesn't need to think that way. God has told David to anoint him because he's going to be the king. Well, he's not the king yet. God never fails in his promises. It's inevitable he's going to live long enough to become king. And David could have just relaxed and said, I don't need to worry about this. But he didn't. He could have gone to Samuel and said, tell me what do I do? I've got Saul on my back and he wants to kill me. How do I deal with this? He doesn't do that. David starts scheming and fretting. And in Psalm 37, David himself will later on say, if you fret, it always leads to evil. And he's at that point of fretting. He's worried about his life. He's worried about his survival. And so he begins taking matters in his own hands rather than simply trusting God. He becomes so anxious that in verse 3 of this chapter, we read, of 1 Samuel 20, we read, yet David vowed again, saying, your father knows well that I have found favor in your sight. And he has said, do not let Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved. But truly as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, there is hardly a step between me and death. He's reading eyes. He's trying to read faces. He's trying to see who his enemies are, who he can count on when his life is in danger. He doesn't just take a deep breath and relax and say, wait a minute, what's the point of this? God's going to make me king. I've got to be alive to be king. I can relax and just trust the Lord. He's going to get me through this, just like he got me through the crisis with Goliath. He gets to the point where he's operating in his own wisdom to such an extent that he asks his best friend Jonathan to lie for him. And sadly, Jonathan does. he wants Jonathan to tell a lie as part of his scheme to figure out what Saul's thinking is so he can escape from Saul. There's no reason for him to think like that, but at this point, he is thinking like that. Sometimes when you have nothing to lose, as David had when he fought Goliath, you do better off spiritually than when you have something to lose. Then you can start hedging your bets and playing a fleshly game that is not a godly game. Well, let's just dive into the text. Verse 20, or chapter 20, verse 1. Then David fled from Naioth in Ramah and came and said to Jonathan, What have I done? What is my iniquity? And what is my sin before your father that he is seeking my life? And he said to him, far from it. Jonathan is really naive at this point. Far from it. You shall not die. Behold, my father does nothing, either great or small, without disclosing it to me. So why should my father hide this thing from me? Is it not so? Yet David vowed, saying, your father knows well that I have found favor in your sight. And he has said, do not let Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved. He's keeping it from you, Jonathan. And as a matter of fact, he is. The question is not, are we fearful? It's for David, it's, are we paranoid enough? And his answer is, I'm not quite paranoid enough yet to protect myself. But truly, as the Lord lives, and as your soul lives, there's hardly a step between me and death. Then Jonathan said to David, whatever you say, I will do. So David said to Jonathan, behold, tomorrow is the new moon. And remember, they're on a lunar calendar. And when the new moon started, there was a 2-day sacrifice that was required to be made at the beginning of each month at the new moon. Behold, tomorrow is the new moon, and I ought to sit down to eat with the king. But let me go. David is saying this to Jonathan. Let me go that I may hide myself in the field until the third evening. If your father misses me at all, then you say, David earnestly asked leave of me to run to Bethlehem, his city, where David was born, because it is the yearly sacrifice there for the whole family. If he says, it is good, your servant shall be safe. But if he is very angry, know that he has decided on evil. Therefore, deal kindly with your servant. David keeps referring to himself as your servant, because remember, he's just a soldier. Jonathan is the prince. He's the one who is in line for the throne next. So he continually refers to himself as your servant. Therefore, deal kindly with your servant, for you have brought your servant into a covenant of the Lord with you. Well, where did that happen? Back in chapter 18, verse 3. Then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. So David's saying, you and I have made this covenant, now make sure you fulfill it. But if there is iniquity in me, put me to death yourself. For why then should you bring me to your father for him to put me to death, in other words? And Jonathan said, far be it from you. For if I should indeed learn that evil has been decided by my father to come upon you, then would I not let you know about it? And that's a Hebraism, or what that means is, of course I would let you know. It's not really, it's a rhetorical question, but beyond that, it's actually an emphatic statement. Then David said to Jonathan, who will tell me if your father answers you harshly? Now, at this point, we see the first of a handful of concepts about true friendship that we can kind of pinpoint. And that is, true friends allow each other to use them for their good and don't resent that. That's part of the deal. I'm at your disposal. I'm available to you, and you are available to me. I will do things for you that I wouldn't do for other people who didn't have this friendship relationship with, and I expect you to do the same for me. Verse 11, and Jonathan said to David, come and let us go out into the field. So both of them went out into the field. Then Jonathan said to David, the Lord, the God of Israel, be witness. When I have sounded out my father about this time tomorrow or on the third day, behold, there is a good feeling toward David. Shall I not then send to you and make it known to you? Jonathan takes David into the field. And there they're going to be able to make their plans, because they're both part of the court. And in a royal court, rumors are everywhere. There's always a rumor going on about something. So in order to avoid that, they need to get away and they need to get by themselves. And rumors can be just rumors for us, but within a court, rumors can be treason. So it can be an extremely dangerous thing. And a king who has all the power he needs to take your life, if he takes offense at you and thinks, or just becomes suspicious of you, thinking that you're committing treason, then he will feel perfectly legitimate and feel he has every good reason to chastise you or put you in jail or even put you to death. So they're trying to make their plans in undisturbed secrecy, and so they go out into this field. And Jonathan feels David's overreacting to his father. Jonathan has completely misread the situation. And it tells us some things about Saul. Saul is clever, much more clever than we thought at first. And Saul is a bit scheming, and he can be pretty hypocritical, so that he's left his son Jonathan with the impression everything is just fine between him and David. And Jonathan has bought into it, and Jonathan wants to think well of his father. He wants to believe his father. It's just that his father is far more corrupt than Jonathan understands. Then Jonathan said to David, "The Lord, the God of Israel, be witness." So he's calling upon God as a witness between him and David that he will fulfill the covenant that he made with David back in chapter 18, verse 3. David is not overreacting. David's life is on the line, and with that kind of jeopardy hanging over his head, he's become pretty discerning and pretty distrustful of Jonathan's father, Saul. Jonathan took a solemn oath to inform David. And what we see here is, as I mentioned before, is that David has begun to fear man rather than God. And Jesus says in Matthew 10:28, we're to fear God rather than man. What can man do it to us? They put us to death, but God can send you to hell. So you don't want to fear man, you want to fear God. And David has started fretting. It leads to evil, and he's fearful of a man, Saul. He's forgetting God's sovereignty, which he had depended upon completely when he had fought against Goliath. And we too can get so preoccupied worrying about how people are thinking about us that we can't take our focus off the Lord and just stop trusting him. Verse 13. And here we come. So the first principle that we see here is that Jonathan puts himself at David's disposal and says, "I'll do as you ask. I will even take risk, even of my own life, in order to be of help to you." Second principle we see is that friends deal humbly with one another, and you see that in verses 13 through 17. "If it please my father to do you harm, may the Lord do so to Jonathan," to him, he's the one who's talking here, "and more also, if I do not make it known to you and send you away, that you may go in safety. And may the Lord be with you as he has been with my father." Jonathan knows David is going to be king. He knows David has been anointed by Samuel at the command of God to be king, which means Jonathan knows he's not going to be king in all likelihood. He's the next in line. He's the royal descendant. He's the prince. But he knows God has chosen David to be what Jonathan otherwise would be, the next king. Jonathan doesn't begrudge David that. Jonathan anticipates that. Look at chapter 23, verse 17, where you see you get some insight into Jonathan's attitude to this fact that David's going to be what he otherwise would be. "Thus he said to him, 'Do not be afraid, because the hand of Saul, my father, shall not find you, and you will be king over Israel. And I will be next to you. I'll be your secretary of state or something. I'll be working along beside you. And Saul, my father, knows that also." My father knows I'm on your side, David. Jonathan is a wonderful person. I mean, there are certain people who just stand out in Scripture as wonderful people. Joshua's like that. I just love Joshua. And Daniel's like that. I feel the same way about Daniel. Well, and Barnabas is like that in the New Testament. Jonathan is one of those people, and we find him here in the Old Testament. So he knows that David is God's anointed, and he anticipates serving David as king, not in competing with him for the throne. Jonathan knows that he would inherit that throne, but he feels no malice toward David, he feels no jealousy of David, and there's no guile in Jonathan at all. Jonathan is a living illustration of Philippians 2, verses 3 and 4. Very familiar words, but it's wonderful occasionally to see those words lived out and to see how it looks in real life. Galatians 2, 3, and 4, which is the kenosis passage that we're very familiar with. Do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit. Well, man, if that's not Jonathan, I don't know who it would be. But with humility of mind, let each of you regard one another as more important than himself. Jonathan's the prince. You don't get more important than that, unless you're the king. But he considers David as more important than himself because David has been anointed by God. Do not merely look out for your own personal interest. Jonathan doesn't. But also for the interests of others. He is a true friend. And he fulfills the qualifications of a true friend. Verse 14. And if I am still alive, will you not show me the kindness of the Lord that I may not die? What are you saying, Jonathan? Jonathan was naive with regard to his own father, but Jonathan wasn't a naive person. And he knew how one dynasty is replaced by another dynasty, by civil war. And he knows that the ex-dynasty always reaches back and kills all the potential inheritors of the throne from the previous dynasty, so there's nobody left they can go back to once they get tired of the new dynasty. He knows he's in a terrible spot here. He knows this could easily cost him his life. And as a matter of fact, when we get to chapter 28, we find out it does cost Jonathan his life. He dies. So he says, if I'm still alive, will you show me the loving kindness of the Lord that I may not die? He is a godly man who knows he may not survive once this dynasty change takes place because David's loyalists are likely to view him as a competitor for the throne and come back and take his life. So he asks David to spare him if possible. Jonathan's faith is in God's promise is amazing. Jonathan is a hero. Jonathan does the same kinds of things David does. He takes on multiple people, single-handed, and he defeats them in war. David is a refugee with no army. He has no way of even defending himself. Jonathan is the prince, and yet Jonathan assumes God's going to make David the king, and so he treats him as if David were the prince, and he shows no jealousy here at all. A commentator named W.G. Blakely puts it like this. One knows not whether most to wonder at the faith of Jonathan or the sweetness of his nature, the calmness of Jonathan in contemplating the strange reverse of fortune both to himself and to David is exquisitely beautiful. Really, really true. Somebody who's that unselfish is just a marvel of God's grace. Verse 15, and you shall not cut off your loving kindness from my house forever. So now he expands the promise that he has extracted from David, and David has extracted from him in the covenant of chapter 18, verse 3, and expands it to include his whole family. Not even when the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth. So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, may the Lord require it at the hands of David's enemies. Jonathan knew that all of David's enemies, including Jonathan's own father Saul, is going to be killed in the inevitable revolution that's going to take place to put David on the throne and take Saul off the throne. He knows that this is going to be a divine judgment against Saul, his own father, but Jonathan is content in the knowledge that God has not chosen him to be the new king. He's chosen David, his friend, to be the new king. What, you know, you just look at this guy and you think, what a great guy this is. I don't mind people doing better at certain things than me, except what I want to do well. You know, better preachers than I can get on my nerves. Well, Jonathan is in that position. Here's the guy who is going to take his place. He's been groomed to be king, and he's discovered that's not God's will for him, and he's probably going to lose his life to keep that from happening. God has chosen David over him, and he's asked David to protect his family, not to assassinate them, as was always the norm in the rough and tumble politics of the Middle East at that time, that era. Eventually, David is going to find one of Saul's family, one of Jonathan's family, a lame boy named Mephibosheth, and David's going to take him into his house, and he's going to take care of him. And in chapter 2 Samuel chapter 9, we'll see David actually speaking to Mephibosheth, who he has to search to find if there are any survivors of Jonathan's family, so he can fulfill his covenant with Jonathan. But he does, and he discovers that a lady, a nurse, has protected one little boy from David's contingent, David's army, and in the process of running, the little boy has fallen, he's become lame, but now he's grown up in hiding, he's grown up, and David finds him. And David said to him, "Do not fear, for I will surely show kindness to you for the sake of your father Jonathan, and will restore to you all the land of your grandfather Saul, and you shall eat at my table regularly." David fulfills his covenant with Jonathan. Mephibosheth is not even faithful to David, as it turns out. But David has made this covenant, and he's going to honor it, and he does honor it, because it's a covenant with his friend before God. So Jonathan calls upon Yahweh to enforce his vow with David, and David's vow to him. Verse 17. "And Jonathan made David vow again because of his love for him, because he loved him as he loved his own life." Jonathan loved David as he loved his own life. So he asks for David's vow to protect his family because he trusts David to fulfill his vow back to him and to his family. That gives us a third insight into true friendship. True friends look out for one another's interests. They look out for one another's interests as they would look out for their own interest. Jonathan does that for David, and David does that for Jonathan. A lot of times when we say friendship, we think of something that's a lot cheaper than this. Because Jonathan's going to have to make a terrible sacrifice to look out for his friend's interests and to fulfill the terms of Philippians 2, verses 3 and 4. But he's willing to do it because he's a true friend. We cannot get people to be true friends to us, but we can get us to be true friends to them and hope they'll reciprocate. But we can't control them. We can control us. And if we don't offer true friendship, we're pretty well guaranteed they're not going to reciprocate with true friendship that we haven't given to them. So we can decide, I am going to look out for somebody else's interests. We can do what God does. Why did God love Israel? Why did God choose Israel? Just because he chose to love them. There's no reason for it. There's nothing Israel could look back at themselves and say, this is why God's so good to us. This is why he's been so gracious to us. They had nothing. God just chose, and they just happened to be on the fortunate end of that, the receiving end of that. He chose to show his love to them and set his love upon them. Starting in verse 18, we see a fourth concept pertaining to friendship. And that is simply that friends can and do trust one another. They decide to trust one another, and they prove faithful to that trust. Then Jonathan said to him, to David, "Tomorrow is the new moon, and you will be missed because your seat will be empty. When you have stayed for 3 days, you shall go down quickly and come to the place where you hid yourself on that eventful day, and you shall remain by the easel, the stone easel. And I will shoot 3 arrows to the side of the stone easel, the easel stone, as though I shot at a target. And behold, I will send the lad, saying, 'Go find the arrows.' If I specifically say to the lad, 'Behold, the arrows are on this side of you, get them,' then come, for there is safety for you, and no harm as the Lord lives. But if I say to the youth," his armor bearer, the young boy who's with him, chasing down his arrows, "'Behold, the arrows are beyond you. Go, for the Lord has sent you away.'" In Numbers 10:10 and 28:11-15, God required a large offering at the beginning of each month. And it was multiple animals. It was one ram, it was like 2 oxen, and 7 sheep, I think, and a bunch of other stuff, that animals that were required each month at the beginning of the month at the new moon. And so Saul has always done that, and he's turned it into a political event. He gathers his dignitaries at court for this event, and David, as part of the royal family, since he's now married to Michal, the daughter of Saul, he's expected to be there for this event. All the VIPs in Israel are supposed to be there. After hiding for 3 days, David's going to meet Jonathan at a place called Ezel, and David's probably going to hide behind the stone of Ezel and listen in for Jonathan's voice and the coded message that he's going to send. Either you've gone too far, which means, David, you're out of, what the code of that means, David, you're out of line, you're assuming things about my father that are not true, you've gone too far, back off, come back in, that you're welcome at court. Or the other possibility, you haven't gone far enough, David, you better get out of here, because my father's gonna kill you if you don't. And the second message would mean that events at court had proven David's suspicions about Saul to be right on the mark. Verse 23. As for the agreement of which you and I have spoken, behold, the Lord is between you and me. Now, you know, that sounds good, but who else said that? Anybody remember in the Old Testament who made that same kind of statement, the agreement between you and me, the Lord has noticed it and is going to enforce it? Who else said that?
Jacob and Esau.
Jacob and Esau and Laban. And it wasn't a good thing. When Laban turned loose of Jacob and his two wives and all of his children, he made that statement, may the Lord watch between you and me. You hear that sometimes in weddings. Well, it's not a good thing to say, because it means, and the first one of us who messes up and violates the agreement, may the Lord sock it to him. May the Lord do to him what I'm about to do to this animal, and he'd sacrifice the animal. So there's a little bit of an edge on that statement, and you'd say, well, wait a minute, Jonathan, you're David's best friend. Why are you making that statement? Jonathan may have noticed some things in David. He may have picked up on the fact David's not acting the way he did back when he fought Goliath. David's now hedging his bets. David's now asking him to lie to his father. And Jonathan may have some questions about whether David's where he should be with the Lord, as well as his questions about whether his father's where he should be. One wonders if Jonathan fears that power has done to David what it had done to his father. Power had corrupted his father, and David's now part of the royal court. He's no longer out in the fields watching sheep. He's no longer fighting Goliath and giants. He's now become quite famous in Israel as a warrior, and people are women are singing songs about him killing tens of thousands, and Jonathan has to wonder, I wonder if David is responding to success the same way my father did. Verse 24. So David hid in the field, and when the new moon, the time of the sacrifice, came, the king sat down to eat food. And the king sat on his seat, as usual, or near the door, near the corner, which would be the opposite side of the door, so that if anybody came in, he would see them. The seat by the wall, then Jonathan arose up, and Abner sat down. I'm sorry, I skipped a line there. And the king sat on his seat, as usual, the seat by the wall. Then Jonathan rose up, and Abner sat down by Saul's side, but David's place was empty. Nevertheless, Saul did not speak anything that day, for he thought, it is an accident, he is not clean, surely he is not clean. Jonathan, hopefully I can get my name straight here, sat next to his father, the king. Then Abner came in. Who's Abner? He's the general. He is Saul's uncle, who was made, put in charge of the forces, the military forces of Israel. He's the top general. He comes in. And Jonathan, even though he outranks him because he's in the royal line, he's the prince, he gets up and politely says to this older man, have a seat. Why? Jonathan wants to get out of there. He doesn't want to sit next to his father, because his father's going to ask him a very embarrassing question, which is, where's David? So he uses that as an excuse to get away. Saul assumes that David is absent due to some ceremonial uncleanness, which would be the ways you can become unclean like that are listed in Leviticus 15, 16. Verse 27. And it came about the next day, the second day of the new moon, and it was a two-day festival, that David's place was empty, so Saul said to Jonathan, his son, and this time he nailed him, couldn't escape, why has the son of Jesse, David, not come to the meal either yesterday or today? Jonathan then answered Saul, "David earnestly asked leave of me to go to Bethlehem, for he said, 'Please let me go, since our family has a sacrifice in the city, and my brother has commanded me to attend. And now, if I have found favor in your sight, please let me get away, that I may see my brothers. For this reason, he has not come to the king's table.'" If David doesn't attend, then Saul can't assassinate him. That's why David's not there. He's not in the mood for getting assassinated. Saul's plans are blown, and he's frustrated because he's beginning to suspect Jonathan is part of that plan. He had a to-do list, and at the top of the to-do list during that two-day festival was kill David. He can't do it because David's not within reach. When he asked about David's absence, Jonathan explains it, and he over-explains it. And his reason that he gives for David's not being there is fictitious, and Saul, who is a fairly sharp person, sees right through it. He knows that Jonathan is in on this thing. He knows that Jonathan has now lined himself up with David, and he's pretty sure he knows what David's saying about him to his son Jonathan. So there's a fracture within the family between the king and the prince. And that's dangerous under any circumstances in these days, but it's especially dangerous when you've got a brutal person like Saul on the throne with the power of the military behind him. Verse 30, "Then Saul's anger burned against Jonathan, and he said to him, 'You son of a perverse, rebellious woman, do you not know that you are choosing the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness?'" In other words, your mother will be ashamed of having bore you because of the way you're dealing with this. You deal with this, you're dealing with this the same way Jacob dealt with, or rather Esau dealt with his birthright. He gave it away. Well, you're doing the same thing, Jonathan. The throne is your birthright and you're giving it away. "For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Therefore now send and bring him to me, for he must surely die." Jonathan, I'm doing this for you. I want you to be king. Saul's anger explodes at this point. His words are an attack on Jonathan, not on Jonathan's mother. And they are calculated to trigger an angry response in Jonathan. Saul is very much aware of the friendship between Jonathan and David. And he's beginning to sense that this friendship is a very loyal, stable friendship, and that he can't break into that friendship and use his relationship with his son to regain his loyalties away from David. He has had suspected his son of sedition against him with David, and this lame excuse for David's absence just confirms his suspicions. So Saul accuses Jonathan of throwing away his right to the throne, and it's totally bogus. He's not concerned about Jonathan. He's going to throw a spear at Jonathan in two verses. So how concerned can you be about your own son if you're trying to kill him? Saul is interested in himself. Now, starting in verse 32, we pick up another precept pertaining to friendship. And that is that friends share the same principles and commitments. Verse 32. "But Jonathan answered Saul, his father, and said to him, 'Why should he be put to death? What has he done?'" Well, Saul just gave you an answer for that. What he's done is to just be there taking your place. He's going to take your kingdom away from you. Jonathan just sweeps that aside, just totally ignores it. That's bogus. That's not a real answer. That's not a real reason to take David's life. So he just ignores it. "Then Saul hurled his spear at him to strike him down. So Jonathan knew that his father had decided to put David to death." There's no longer any reason for any pretense on Jonathan's part. He just lays his cards down and plays them straight. And Jonathan demands a just cause for why David should be put to death. And political expediency is not a just cause. Saul had given no reason. All he does is answer Jonathan by throwing a spear at him. And as he does that, all of the guests, all the dignitaries who are gathered there to celebrate the new moon feast with him, see him do that. In other words, he blows his credibility right out of the sky by taking a shot at his own son who's supposed to take his place on the throne. Mercifully, God spared Jonathan at that point. Saul's actions persuade Jonathan that his father's never going to repent, that he's never going to relent until either he or David is dead. And he's exactly right. Jonathan may have simply viewed his father as unstable before, but now Jonathan realizes his father is deeply captured by his own wickedness. Then Jonathan arose from the table in fierce anger and did not eat food on the second day of the new moon, for he was grieved over David because his father had dishonored him. That brings us to verse 35 and another principle of friendship. Friends keep their commitments to one another. Verse 35, and that's what Jonathan does. Now it came about in the morning that Jonathan went out into the field for the appointment with David. And a little lad was with him, and he said to his lad, "Run, find now the arrows which I am about to shoot." As the lad was running, he shot an arrow past him. When the lad reached the place of the arrow which Jonathan had shot, Jonathan called after the lad and said, "Is not the arrow beyond you?" And Jonathan called after the lad, "Hurry, be quick, do not stay." And Jonathan's lad picked up the arrow and came to his master, Jonathan. But the lad was not aware of anything, only Jonathan and David knew about the matter. Then Jonathan gave his weapons to his lad and said to him, "Go bring them to the city." Jonathan fulfills his promise to David. He uses this predetermined code to let David know his life is in danger and he needs to flee. And then Jonathan adds a little extra to emphasize the urgency by saying, "Hurry, be quick, do not stay." Verse 41, and here we find the next to last principle, and that is friends feel deep respect and affection for one another, and that affection just grows with time. Verse 41, when the lad was gone, David rose from the south side and fell on his face to the ground and bowed three times, bowing before the prince, Jonathan. And they kissed each other and wept together, but David more. Finally, Jonathan throws caution to the wind. And in doing so, he risks being charged with treason by his father. He sends his armor bearer home and meets with David face to face. And he probably felt that this would be the last such meeting with him. And as it turns out, it almost is. There's one more meeting in chapter 23 between David and Jonathan when Jonathan just simply meets with David to encourage David. But for all intents and purposes, this is the last meeting. And David bows down before Jonathan. And what a significant, meaningful gesture that is. In bowing down before Jonathan, he's recognizing Jonathan as the rightful heir to the throne, the royal prince, if God had not intervened and changed the plan and anointed David. He's also giving an expression of gratitude to a friend who has proven himself faithful even at the risk of his own life. That bow before Jonathan's also an acknowledgement of the sacrifice Jonathan was making, giving up the throne for David. It's also a gesture of admiration. These are two soldiers, heroic soldiers, both of whom have killed many people and done so under terrible circumstances that in which their own lives are threatened. They've both done that. There's an admiration, a camaraderie between these two men. And finally, it's an act of affirmation that David would now fulfill his vow. And then in typical Middle East fashion, they kissed one another as men still do on the cheek in that part of the world. Verse 42. And Jonathan said to David, "Go in safety, inasmuch as we have sworn to each other in the name of the Lord, saying, 'The Lord will be between you and me, between me and you, and between my descendants and your descendants forever.' Then he rose and departed, while Jonathan went to the city." From here on, throughout the rest of the book, David's going to be a fugitive, constantly running from Jonathan's father, Saul, and Saul's army. Later on, hearing of Jonathan's death in battle in chapter 28, David's going to say this, "I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. You have been very pleasant to me. Your love to me was more wonderful than the love of women." Solomon may have been thinking about his father's friendship with Jonathan when he wrote later on, "There is a friend who sticks closer than a brother." Few of us may ever be fortunate enough to have that deep a friendship as Jonathan and David share together, except one. We have one friend who will do for us what Jonathan did for David. Jesus, I no longer call you servants, I call you friends. A friend layeth down his life for his brother. Jesus laid his life down for us. Even if we have no other friends like David and Jonathan had, we have Jesus. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for this beautiful passage in which we learn the truths of your word, and in this case, apply them in terms of friendship with other men and women of like precious faith. Father, we can't control whether anyone will befriend us like that, but help us to be those kinds of friends to other people. We thank you sincerely and wholeheartedly for the friendship you've given us in Jesus Christ, the friend who has saved our souls. We bless and praise your name for it. In Jesus' name, amen.